But on this significant Anzac Day, I'd like to pose a thought-provoking question. It's not my question, but one very carefully considered in a book that examines the notion that it is war, not peace, that's brought stability and prosperity to the modern world, that war makes the state and the state makes peace. The archaeologist and historian Ian Morris is the Jean and Rebecca Willard Professor in Classics and Professor in History at the Stanford Archaeology Centre in California. His biography reads that he's interested in understanding why the West has dominated the earth for the last few centuries. And last year, as part of this research, he published War, What Is It Good For? The Role of Conflict in Civilization from Primates to Robots, to wide acclaim, and we'll come to him shortly to explain. Also joining the conversation are a couple of former soldiers. In London, Sir Robert Fry, a former Commandant General of the Royal Marines, former Deputy Commanding General of the Coalition Forces in Iraq, and still, and knows the one arm of the British Special Forces very well, the Special Reconnaissance Regiment, where he still holds the rank of Colonel, even though he's now moved into business advisory positions. He's also a visiting professor at King's College in London. Here in Australia, I'd like to welcome Jim Molan, who retired with the rank of Major General after 40 years in the Australian Defence Force in 2008. He commanded at every level, from a platoon to a 15,000-strong division. For distinguished command and leadership in action in Iraq, he was awarded the Distinguished Service Cross and the Legion of Merit by the US government. And his best-selling book, Running the War in Iraq, was published in 2008. And you probably also know that he's a former special envoy for the Abbott government's Operation Sovereign Borders. And he's put his hand up for Senate pre-selection for the Liberal Party in New South Wales. So, gentlemen, welcome to you all.
Thanks, Geraldine.
Thank you.
Quite a trio you make. Ian Morris, where did this idea of yours come from, that war is ultimately responsible for greater good than peace?
I wouldn't put it quite that way. But
I thought you did, actually.
Well, I'd been spent a lot of time looking at world history in the very long term, across like tens of thousands of years, and trying to see what the big patterns in history are. And one of the things I noticed doing this was, you know, every time something really big happens in the story in world history, there's always a lot of violence involved in these big turning points. And so that made me decide, clearly, you know, this is a topic that it would be worth writing a whole book about, thinking very seriously about. And so what the conclusion I came to after I'd spent, you know, a few years thinking and looking into the history, the anthropology, the archaeology of war, is that we see this really weird pattern playing out over the very, very long term of thousands of years, that the big force in history that's driven the creation of governments and big organized societies, the big force has been violence. One group of people conquers another group of people, combines them to make a bigger society. But then what happens over and over again is, like, the minute you get this larger society formed, the people running it feel they're under a lot of pressure to pacify the society. Because, like, if you are, you know, the king or the aristocrats or whatever in one society, and your people are all running around killing each other, burning each other's farms down and not paying taxes, you are much weaker than a neighboring society where they're not doing that. So the more you can pacify your society, the more successful you're likely to be. And the weird result of this, played out over thousands and thousands of years, is that war drove the formation of big states and governments, and the big states and governments then pacified the people. And the rates of violent death have come down and down. So that's kind of why I say I wouldn't quite put it to say a war is more important than peace. Seems to me like the two are kind of inseparable, even though it sounds like a paradox. You have peace, the absence of war, yet you're not going to get peace without the wars that have created these big governments that can then set up the requirements for peace. So I'd say the two go together.
And is it that you have to have war that is totally won in order to stop the ongoing nature of war? Like, you have this great phrase, war makes the state and the state makes peace. Now, I presume those terrible, rumbling, ongoing wars that absolutely laid waste to Europe, that you're not talking about, are you talking about that sort of war?
Well, I mean, war comes in all kinds of forms, obviously. And one of the things I try to do in my book was not draw lots of firm boundaries saying, this is a war, this is not a war. And think more generally just in terms of violence, all the way up from, two guys having a punch up in a bar, all the way up to the German invasion of the Soviet Union, say. It's all just different levels of violence going on. So, the kind of wars that we've seen, say, in Europe in the 20th century, and obviously we've got the anniversary of Anzac Day, these kinds of wars, I think that in a way they really illustrate how the bigger story works. If you look at, say, the First World War, just on its own terms, 1914 to 18, it's difficult to see much point to what was going on. It just seems it's a totally pointless slaughter of people. And yet, if you step back from the details and look at it, say, within the context of the last 500 years, what you see then is that it was the First World War was one of the stages in this much longer series of wars that produced the first powers that really had an influence across the entire planet. So first of all, the British Empire comes out of the wars against Napoleon. The culmination of this is the creation of this British system that bestrides the world. The wars from 1914 to 1945 entirely sweep that order away. They end up splitting the world between two great spheres of influence, the American and the Soviet. And then the Cold War ends up with the collapse of the Soviet system. And we've really once again got a global system which I would say does a lot to drive down rates of violence all around the world. So the First World War, I say, we see what it means when we put it into this longer term perspective. And we see that, taken on its own terms, it's this terrible slaughter, at least 15 million people die, maybe more, die violently. Looked at more broadly, it's one stage in a larger progression which has produced a world that is much, much more peaceful than it was 500 years ago.
And I'm going to come to that. In fact, you differentiate between productive and counterproductive war. Mm-hmm. I wonder, could you give us an example of each?
Well, talking about productive wars, obviously, it's a way to get focus people's attention on what's going on here, because it's a provocative way to describe it. But I would say you looked at across the 10, 15,000 years we can document it, wars have been productive in one very specific way. And what they've produced is these bigger, larger governments that pacify societies and drive down rates of violent death. And they can be productive in that sense while also being incredibly non-productive, destructive in almost every other sense. So there's a period of about 3,000 years long in an area stretching from the Mediterranean to China, where broadly speaking, war is productive. It creates the Roman Empire, the Mauryan Empire in India, the Han Dynasty Empire in China. But then in the early first millennium AD, you enter a period when wars across the same area, wars turn counterproductive. And I think that we can figure out the reasons why this happens. But you start getting these invasions from the steppes, from nomads coming in, breaking up the big empires, and rates of violent death go back up again. And so you get this alternation, the productive and the counterproductive wars, but it plays out and you can only really see it across these really long time spans.
Yes. In fact, I wondered, for instance, about, the PNG warriors and the Irish were somewhat bedeviled, I think, the PNG still, by this constant almost becoming in love with the nature of conflict and not being able to lay it aside to move to a better organising principle.
Yeah, well, it's huge controversy over what Stone Age warfare was like. And we know a certain amount about it from archaeology. And then there are a few cases where basically Stone Age level technology societies survived into the 20th century, more or less uncontacted by outside groups. And yet Papua New Guinea, the New Guinea Highlands, is one of the big areas of this. And the headwaters of the Orinoco and the Amazon in South America are the other big area of this. And in both of these places, what anthropologists found in the 20th century, when they were able to talk to people who had not had much contact with outside colonial powers, they found really violent societies. And typically, you're talking about rates of violent death 10 to 20%. So the average person has a 1 in 10 or even a 1 in 5 chance of dying violently. Whereas, say, in the 20th century industrialized world, in spite of two world wars, nuclear weapons, genocides being committed, the rate of violent death has fallen to 1 to 2%. So it's fallen by 90%. So the big argument is, are the societies that were still available for academics to study 50 years ago in Highland New Guinea, in the headwaters of the Orinoco, are those representative of what almost all human societies were like 10,000 years ago? Or are they actually, are the modern examples real outliers? There's something weird about them. And in fact, the prehistoric world was really, really peaceful. So this is one of the big academic debates that went into the writing of this book, figuring out what the right answer is to these questions.
Now, just before, I mean, loads of questions, before I go to our two soldiers who've read your book, I'm so pleased you mentioned, even in passing, the Chinese, because generally speaking, we never include them in our discussions of sweeps of history, and yet we should. Is there a different set of experiences in the world of China, reaching back, 3,000 to 5,000 years?
Yeah, I would say not really. You know, a lot of people like to think, oh, you know, East is East and West is West and never the twain shall meet. But that just doesn't seem to be true. And the stories in different parts of the world, say in Europe, in China, in the New World, these stories are all different from each other. But I would say that what we see is, say, Eastern and Western societies follow very similar paths in the way they develop. The big difference between them was that the agricultural revolution, you know, the beginning of farming, began a couple of thousand years earlier at the western end of the old world, say the Mediterranean basin, than it did at the eastern end of the old world. So the societies at the western end, for most of the last 10,000 years, the societies at the western end of the old world were the more developed, more complex, more powerful ones. But the way they develop are really very, very similar. I mean, there are some people who say, oh, well, eastern societies are more peaceful than western societies, and westerners are inherently aggressive and warlike. And the history really doesn't bear that out at all.
Okay, look, thank you very much indeed. That's just a snapshot of Ian's very complicated thesis that is in his book. Could I bring in Sir Robert Fry now, who's very much been to war and seen the harsh end of conflict? What do you think of these conclusions that Ian is drawing, Robert?
Well, a couple of things really strike me from what Ian has just said. First is the unbroken history of the 20th century. I completely buy that. It's impossible to understand Soviet exhaustion in 1989 unless you understand German aggression in 1914. And there is a sequence of events that joins those two things inseparably. This is not a novel idea of mine. I mean, lots of books, not least by Eric Hobsbawm, the Cambridge Marxist historian, have made the same point. Something that really strikes me these days is the relevance of the 30 Years' War, fought over what was then the Holy Roman Empire in Germany. You mentioned earlier on about these endless, pitiless, formless wars that have often characterized history in Europe. Well, that was never more true than during the period 1618 to 1648. And to that extent, it is a profound example of what Ian has called a destructive war. But from that came a political doctrine, the Westphalian doctrine about non-interference in nation states, the definition of national borders, and freedom of worship, that actually then created the circumstances for the Enlightenment in the following century. And it seems to me this is an example not of necessarily of governments establishing order, but human beings going through a catastrophic experience. And partially as a result of that, them trying to find or to seek some intellectual order that they take out of it. I alight on the 30 Years' War because I think we're in at the end of the first decade of the 30 Years' War of the 21st century. This time it's being fought within Islam between Sunni and Shia rather than within Christianity between Protestants and Catholics.
Oh, interesting. I thought you might have been going to cite the European Union, interestingly, as a sort of product of the, well, that came straight out of conflagration, of the terrible experience of World War II, that there had to be a better way for Europe to organise itself.
You could say that, and I think that follows Ian's thesis. Whether that actually has established anything resembling political viability, certainly not economic viability in Europe at the present time is another issue entirely.
Mm. I mean, it is interesting, Ian Morris, that the European Union story is so, so interesting to consider in the light of your thesis. I would also cite, when I really thought about it, our own federation in Australia, which I think is sort of grossly understated, mm-hmm. that was achieved without any shots fired in anger, essentially, very much devised by people who didn't have experience of doing this in the past, who drew together a whole range of fractious states and made this country called Australia. We don't really know how to celebrate it, Ian Morris.
Yeah, because I guess the Aboriginals in Australia, I guess, would probably disagree.
Oh,
with
they
that
absolutely would disagree. That's quite so.
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, this is one of the things you keep running into trying to write a book like the one that I did. That, you know, every historical issue you look at, it turns out there's, you know, multiple sides to it you can always argue about. Like, I mean, the European Union that you were mentioning a moment ago, you know, one of the big arguments in my book is that war creating these bigger governments, this has been the major driver of the very slow move toward a safer world. And if I want to make that argument, of course, I'm saying that there are no really convincing examples, or very few, of other mechanisms producing a safer world. And one of the obvious counter cases is the European Union. But about the EU, I mean, I grew up in Britain as like a teenager in the 1970s when a lot of the big discussions were going on about the European Union. And I thought it was the most boring thing that had ever happened in the history of the planet. And yet, the moment it came on TV, I would turn off and do anything rather than listen to this. But, you know, looking back at it now, it seems like in some ways, this is one of the most remarkable experiments people have ever attempted to do. And in some ways, they brought together tens of millions of people, this time really without a shot being fired, and agreed to give up lots of sovereignty and lots of national independence to create what is now, you know, even after the rising tensions in recent years, it's still, you know, the biggest, safest, and in most ways the richest part of the world. And yet I do think there's a way you can look at what happened in the EU and say, oh, this really is an example of exactly the kind of thing I've been talking about. That, you know, not only is it the product of World War II and driven very much by American interest in creating a more peaceful, stable Western Europe, but also it's very much the product of the Cold War, that this sort of union gets the kind of support it does largely, I would say, because the US is so keen to see an organization like this form to help them keep the Soviets at bay. And I think there's a lot of cases through history where you can say, you know, this looks a little bit like large numbers of people moving toward bigger, safer societies without violence being involved. Okay. The early history of the US is actually another one of these. But I think in every case, when you get into the details, you start to see, oh, you know, wait a minute, there's a bit more going on here. The shadow of violence is always hanging over these cases. And it seems to me that really what people are saying is, we maybe don't want to give up a lot of our sovereignty to Brussels or to Canberra or whatever it might be, but the alternative is worse. The alternative is violence, and we just don't want that.
Well, let me go to Jim Mullen, who's been very patiently waiting. Jim, how do you
it's
hear this?
Fascinating, Geraldine.
It is. Good. Well, what's your take on Ian's argument?
Oh, I really enjoyed the book, Ian, and I guess for the initiated, like Sir Robert and yourself and I, who I imagine read a fair bit of this, the first and the last chapters I found absolutely fascinating. I read so much technical stuff at the moment that it's just fantastic to be forced to step back and look at the sweep of human history. You base the title of the book on War, What's It Good For?
Yes.
And I'd bastardise another one, and that another song, that is Give War a Chance. I think it was a Beatles song. Geraldine, you'd know that. I think it was
my generation.
and mine, I think, as well. But what I found interesting about it was to keep thinking back as I read the book to what are the policy implications of what Ian is saying? What's its usefulness for policy? And I don't doubt what Ian is saying, that between the Stone Age and now, that the percentage of the population that's died from violent human actions has dropped from 10 to 20% to 1 to 2%. The problem then, of course, is that if 50% of that 1% to 2% happens to be in Australia or in our region or something like that, and if you were a Syrian or a European, of course, you'd have a vastly different view of where we are on that scale.
Yes.
And what fascinates me just about more than anything else, was the way Ian talks about the global cop, the global policeman, that it was written a long time ago. The US took over for Britain. And there's a possibility, of course, that as we go from war to state to peace to prosperity, that countries like China, and Germany did it to Britain centuries ago, that countries like China may rise to challenge the global cop. And if someone had have said to me, as I think Ian puts in his book, that there was only a 20% chance of conflict between China and the US in the next decade, to me that's a terrifying figure, because it's our region, it's our neighbourhood. And I guess the last thing I'd say is that where Ian ends up in the book is that war will do away with itself, robot on robot, and if one set of robots in some future war totally dominates and all you've got left is humans, then that will be the end of war, if I've got that right. Of course, the human nature is such that many human beings, although faced with imminent destruction, may not accept that and then move into a non-war society, a non-violent society. We have, throughout history, we have had human forces who have faced imminent destruction yet have fought on and survived. And I thought it was a great book and very thought-provoking.
Yes, and we're going to get to the future in just a moment. One of the things I do just want to come back to before we do, I wondered, Ian, as I was reading your book, whether you had downgraded the role of technological change and big movements. So you've drawn the conclusion that actually the misery of war does give way to human ingenuity, which makes the peace. And then that's sort of essentially. Mm-hmm. And if we're not in the moment, in the time of mass murder, as you say, people, the war is good for humanity and makes it safer, but only through mass murder. But I wondered if, like the Industrial Revolution, for instance, and the Agricultural Revolution and the Tech Revolution we're living through now, these big epochal changes, why aren't they as important as war? You don't seem to accord them the same respect.
Well, I think, you know, obviously the technological changes are important, and the shift towards coal and steam power and oil and all of the new forms of power we've got today, the new forms of processing information, all of these things are hugely important. But it seems to me one way to think about the role of technology in this story has been that it's technology is driven along by the creation of these bigger economic systems and more people integrated together, more and more wealth available for discovery. And of course, you can't leapfrog from the Stone Age to the Computer Age. You have to go through all these stages that happen in between. And all of them depend on new kinds of societies being created along the way. So I would say there's this feedback between technology and the story I'm telling about violence and the creation of states and how they push the world toward peace. And the more you move toward the bigger, more complicated societies, the more impressive and sophisticated the technology gets. And we've got kind of two stories going on at once almost. On the one hand, the story is pushing the world toward lower rates of violent death. On the other hand, it's constantly raising the stakes for when things do break down and people do start to use violence to solve their problems. And you can see people starting to worry about this already 200 years ago. The destructive power of Napoleonic armies was a big step up from what had been seen before. And then when you start to get machine guns and steamships and all these things coming in, another great leap. And so by 100 years ago, we've gotten to the point we can wage wars so destructive that pretty much the whole European state system collapses under the weight of World War One. And then, of course, the great watershed is nuclear weapons, which I think has really changed everything. We have the potential to kill almost everybody on the planet if we really put our minds to it, even though the number of people dying violently is now lower than ever before. So once again, it seems to me this is one of these parts of the story. You've got two things going on at once.
You say it's always paradoxical, war. And I'm just going to let everyone know who they're listening to. On this special Anzac Day, we're debating the notion that war is good for peace here on Saturday Extra. My guests are the archaeologist and historian Ian Morris from Stanford University, whose book is War, What's It Good For? And my other guests are former soldier Sir Robert Fry in London and Jim Molan, who retired from the Australian Army with the rank of Major General with an Australian perspective. If we look now in the last section of our discussion about the future and how we might apply it, you've got a wonderful line from the former Secretary of Defence, Robert Gates, telling West Point cadets in 2011, when it comes to predicting the nature and the location of our next military engagements, our record has been perfect. We have never once got it right. So, where does all of this... Well, it's a sort of fairly terrifying prospect. If your thesis is right and he's right, where we head from here? Just quickly from you, Ian, before I go to our two other gents who are soldiers.
Yeah, your other two guests are the experts who can say something sensible about this. But, I mean, my impression from looking at the long-term history is that people, like statesmen on the whole, they've been pretty good at identifying what the general strategic problems are and saying, you know, say some of the Roman emperors were able to look and say, well, okay, we realize that the success of the empire has created this big, powerful economic engine that is making the people across the frontier richer and more sophisticated. And they are getting to be more of a challenge to the integrity of the frontiers. And we need to do something about that. So it's like they can recognize the strategic problem. But then when it comes to saying, okay, so where exactly is the storm going to break? Is it going to be on the Danube frontier? Is it going to be on the Rhine? Is it going to be up in Scotland? When it comes to trying to pinpoint the detail, they're much less good at this. And this, I think, is what Robert Gates was trying to say, that, you know, we can, from the US perspective, we can look at the changing balance of power in the world and say, yeah, well, clearly, you know, China is becoming much richer, much more serious player on the military political scene. There's a very good chance that we're going to see people's confidence in America's ability to keep the peace and maintain existing frontiers. We're going to see confidence waning in that. And the obvious implication might be, well, we should expect the next conflict to blow up in the South China Sea or Taiwan or somewhere like that. But of course, what we've seen just recently is that that's not necessarily the case. A lot of analysts here in the US think that the aggression we've seen from the Russians recently has been driven by exactly this strategic shift. Russians are beginning to be less certain that the US is actually capable of preserving the existing structure of boundaries. And so it turns out to be the Russians who are, you know, pushing and being really aggressive. And I think, you know, the more you come down from the 30,000-foot view, the big strategic picture, the more you come down to the actual details, the harder it becomes to predict where things are going.
Jim Molan?
Oh, I absolutely agree. And the big challenge that we face in Australia is to admit that what Robert Gates said was correct. And Robert Gates said some amazing things, particularly in his book, that what we face in Australia, and I'm quite sure it's not that unique, is that our military and our defence policies must be based on uncertainty as the basic principle. If you're in Poland at the moment, it would be fairly easy to redefine or to define your defence policy and the orientation of your defence force. And they have done that at the moment, and they've done it recently and made changes recently, reacting to what Ian was talking about, that Russia has emerged in a different way. We must admit in Australia, I think, that uncertainty is what it's all about. We too quickly, in the commentary that surrounds our defence debate in this country, we go to scenarios such as South China Sea or Middle East or whatever. Mm. We have never been able to predict exactly where the next fight is going to be, as Ian said, and therefore, in defining your defence force, the major determinant of the structure of your defence force must be uncertainty. That doesn't mean you don't do anything, but it does mean that you must give yourself the ability to change and adjust that defence force as time goes on. So if I'm looking for policy implications of what Ian is saying, Geraldine, I think that's where I'd come from.
So, Robert?
I don't entirely buy the Gates thesis. I think sometimes it is possible to see war coming. It was perfectly possible to see war coming before 1914. What we couldn't see was the proximate cause. Nobody could say that the assassination of an Austrian archduke in Sarajevo would start it. But There was a sense of Britain, France, and Germany on some sort of collision course. Same was true before 1939. We started rearming a couple of years before 1939 because, again, we could see war coming. So I don't think it's an unbroken record of failure. But what, of course, we couldn't see is something like 9/11. There was it was completely impossible to foresee the scale and the subsequent consequences of that. One thing I would like to touch on, and it's something that Ian mentioned, but I think maybe it needs more emphasis, is this great watershed that's represented by the use of nuclear weapons. Up until the dropping of the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, what generals were about, what military force was about, was essentially using force in order to gain a decision over an adversary. Once you have the ability to entirely destroy the world, the use of military force is not to be employed. The whole thing about nuclear weapons is that the theory of deterrence means that you do not go to war. It also means that policy lies in the hands of civilians rather than in generals. Now, you can have whatever view you like on that. But it seems to me that 1945 marked a real turning point. Now, the wars that we've been fighting for the last 10 years tends to obscure the importance of nuclear weapons because there's been no chance, there's been no likelihood of recourse to nuclear weapons in what is in the counterinsurgency wars we've been fighting recently. But if you look at what's happening in the Middle East present time, there is a potentially profoundly dangerous set of circumstances building up, which is the potential for multiple simultaneous nuclear proliferation. Now, we came within a hair's breadth of destroying the world in the 1960s, and that was with just two sides, with maybe three, four, or half a dozen nuclear-armed states in South Asia and the Middle East. If that was to happen, if Iran was to proceed with getting a bomb and if others were to follow, then I think we would be in absolutely profoundly dangerous circumstances. So let's just keep an eye on the whole nuclear issue.
Yes, look, we have to sort of draw to a close. I suppose I really wanted to ask you all, one of the phrases, you know, the great phrase, I think, that the Roman generals, if you want peace, prepare for war. And I think a lot of listeners will be saying, we do not want to live like that. You know, that by definition, it says you don't prepare for peace and don't put all your best energies there. And I just wonder, I'm going to come to you first, Ian Morris, whether in moving to the future, is that what you think we've got to feel like? That just as we're actually enjoying the peace and really starting to dream that we might move to a 21st century, which is quite something, and that technology may rule, in fact, and bring us all sorts of dividends. Are you saying that that is unwise?
Well, not exactly unwise. I guess what I would say is that the more successful people are at creating what the philosopher Thomas Hobbes called the Leviathan, this great, powerful government that has so much force at its disposal that everybody's scared straight. And you don't use violence because you know you'll be punished by some much more powerful force. The more successful we are at creating that, then the less people even think about using violence. I mean, most of us today in rich, industrialized countries, most of us don't run around killing people. And we decide not to kill people, not because we're thinking, oh boy, I would love to kill, say this interviewer has given me a difficult question on a radio show, I'd love to kill you, but I know I'll be arrested and beaten to death by the cops or whatever. You're not thinking that. It doesn't really cross your mind anymore to use violence to solve your problems. Because we've been so successful at creating these strong societies, strong organizations, which make that just seem like a really dumb move. Using violence is just a dumb move. People stop thinking about it altogether. And so I would say that what we should be thinking about here is not so much that we're going to be constantly worrying about weighing up the need to prepare for war against the risks of not doing so, as that the more successful we are, the less that is even going to be on people's minds.
And Sir Robert Fry, how do you, as an ex-soldier, think about this?
I'd love to think that we were going into some sunlit upland, but I think one of the things that Ian has just mentioned, which is that part of the world is very, very successful, has levels of prosperity which have never been experienced previously in human history. But other parts of the world are embittered and still very poor. The sense within Islam at the present time of victimhood and some long-term historical injury, which is yet to be entirely reconciled, means that while part of the world can be prosperous and forward-looking, until such time as that embraces the whole of the world, then I think that there is the truism is that until such time as you can guarantee peace, make sure you make appropriate provision for war.
Jim Molan?
Thanks, Geraldine. I think that we should thank Ian for what he's produced in it makes us think about war. And I think that's tremendous. But I don't think that preparing for war and preparing for peace are mutually exclusive. You can do both, certainly in our circumstances in this part of the world. On this day, on Anzac Day, Australians are looking at their myths and their legends in a way that I have never seen us do before. And sometimes we confuse our myths with our legends. Legends have a chance of being true. And I think we're in the middle of that at the moment.
Yes.
And just to paraphrase a friend of mine, James Brown, who wrote a book about this recently, talking about Australia, he said, "We don't want honour that is based on hubris or a society that fetishes war but does not know how to fight them." And I would add to the song, "Give War a Chance."
That's a lovely end. Look, Ian Morris, I think you can see what you have provoked. And I think this is truly, I must advise listeners, a very quick snapshot of your long study. So thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me on in such distinguished company.
And Sir Robert Fry, thank you for joining us once more.
Not at all. It was a great pleasure, even if it did mean staying up until midnight.
indeed so. And Jim Molan, thanks for you. I mean, obviously, you're right in the midst of it, as I am here in Australia, with, the, as you say, the legends and the myths around us. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks, Geraldine.
And Jim's book is actually Running the War in Iraq. Sir Robert Fry contributed to the collection Wars in Peace, British Military Operations Since 1991, also published last year. And the book that we were discussing, War, What Is It Good For? The Role of Conflict in Civilization from Primates to Robots. That's a profile book. Ian Morris was the author, distributed by Allen and Unwin. And most intrigued to get your thoughts on the many, many different ideas put forward in that particular discussion.